moment. And beneath that four-beat rhythm, other, other, hang the other, was a rapid three-beat vibration. Puppeteer, puppeteer. A frightened bass beneath an already violent descant. Corlant had truly convinced the tribe that Isolde was the puppeteer, and now she would die for it. Then the oak loomed before Isolde, a mass of jagged lines against a bright, moonlit sky. A man grabbed at Isolde's breast, his threads erratically shaking. A woman raked her nails down Isolde's cheek, her threads starved for violence. As spots of pain flecked Isolde's vision, her heart finally hardened into the stone it was meant to be. Her pulse slowed. Her body temperature plummeted. And all the sights, sounds, and pain of the moment vanished behind a wall of objective thought. This attack was fueled by Corlant. By fear. The people were afraid of the cleaved and the unknown puppeteer, and therefore afraid of Isolde.
With your right hand, give a person what he expects, and with your left hand, cut his purse.
Sever! The word boiled up in Isolde's throat, hissed out with spittle. Sever! She repeated again, the same hiss, the same thoroughly blank expression on her face. Twist and sever! Then again, sever, sever, twist and sever! It was the same rhythm as the crowd's strumming threads, their pulsing fear. Isolde latched on to that four-beat song and three-beat bass. Then she gave them what they wanted to see. She gave them a puppeteer. Sever, sever, twist and sever, threads that break, threads that die! The words she screamed were gibberish. Isolde couldn't touch these people's threads, and she certainly couldn't control them. But the Nomadzis didn't know that. So on she chanted. Sever, sever, twist and sever, threads that break, threads that die. Louder, Isolde shrieked, until there was enough space for her to straighten. For her to inhale and yell all the more, until at last the bloodthirsty threads began to drown beneath the blinding white threads of fear. Corlant was nowhere to be seen. Then a new distraction arrived. A fire pot flew through the air, and Gretcha's voice lashed out, "Ignite!" The pot exploded. Isolde dropped to the ground as flaming shards whistled down. Her mother hadn't abandoned her. People ran. Isolde ran too, toward her mother's voice, toward her mother's house. Yet as her feet pounded the dirt and exploding pots flashed on other houses, ignited thatch rooftops and sent the Nomadzi into panicked flight, Isolde felt the threads around her shift once more. It always happened, that moment when Amark realized he'd been cheated, and it was happening now. The people were noticing they'd lost their puppeteer, yet their taste for blood had not been sated. It had only grown. Isolde reached the edge of her mother's house, but Gretcha was nowhere in sight.
Isolde!
Her gaze snapped left. Alma bolted toward her on an unsaddled mare. Its brown coat and black legs were almost invisible in the darkness, as was Alma's black gown. Alma reined the horse to a stop and heaved Isolde onto the bay in front of her. A traditional Nomadzi shield was strapped to Alma's back, a wooden square meant to protect a Nomadzi on the run. Alma set the bay into a gallop toward the gate. The keen of the people's threads stretched tighter, pulsed faster. They knew they had been duped. Which was why stones began to zip toward the girls. Why the unmistakable thwang of loosed bows filled the air along with Corlant's roars, "Stop them! Kill them!" But Isolde and Alma were to the oaks by the wall now. The stones pounded into tree trunks, arrows clattered through branches, and thunked into Alma's shield.
"Where's my mother?"
Isolde shouted. The gate was closing in fast. And it was shut.
No,
not shut.
Cracked. Swinging ajar.
Alma aimed the horse for that widening gap. The bay changed the trajectory of her gallop, briefly exposing the girl's right sides. Something punched into Isolde's right bicep. The force of it knocked her sideways, into the cage of Alma's arms. She didn't know what had hit her. A stone, perhaps? But the pain throbbed. She looked down, alarmed, and saw the tip of a needle arrowhead poking through the skin above her elbow. A long cedar shaft with black and white cock feathers came out the other end. She threw back a single glance and saw Corlant, lowering a bow and wearing a satisfied smile on his moonlit face. Then Alma's voice was shrieking in her ear, "Hold on!" So Isolde turned away and held on as they galloped into the moonlit meadow, the cries of the villagers briefly blocked out by the gate. Isolde's legs squeezed tight, and her toes pointed up like her mother had taught her.
Mother! Isolde squinted, and she thought she saw a figure on horseback bouncing over the grass, with a smaller figure right behind. Scruffs! Gretcha must have opened the gate and made a run for it, trusting Alma to get Isolde out.
Corlant clearly knows what Alma and I have planned.
That was what Gretcha had said. A plan. A plan against Corlant, who clearly wanted Isolde dead, even if Isolde couldn't possibly fathom why. For half a breath, Isolde wished she'd faced the Blood Witch instead of Corlant, instead of the tribe. Yet that idea vanished almost instantly, for at least now she lived. Had the Blood Witch tried to shoot her, she didn't think he would have missed. Corlant had almost succeeded, though. If his arrow had gone 3 inches to the left, Isolde's chest would have been pierced. A single inch to the right would have ruptured a vital artery. So Isolde sent a silent thanks to the moon they now galloped beneath, along with a prayer that Safi was still out there waiting for her, and that the Blood Witch was not. 11.
The Blood Witch named Edwin was bored. There was only so much wrist-rolling, finger-flexing, and ankle-wiggling he could do to keep his muscles primed for fighting, or keep his temper at bay. 4 chimes had passed since he'd first stretched out on this rafter in the Doge's palace ceiling, and he had long ago pulled back his hood and even undone the buckles along the top of his cloak. Since the only people to see him were the 16 other hired guards in the rafters, and a family of pigeons who hadn't stopped cooing since Edwin had sprawled out beside their nest, he wasn't particularly worried about this breach in Carowen protocol reaching the monastery. Even if it did, the old monks cared more about mercenary missions than they did about respecting the Carowen. After all, the Carowen was just a myth. But bronze piastras were quite real. Yet always just out of Edwin's reach. Yotaluzzi had declared a bounty on the 2 girls who'd held up his carriage. And Edwin wanted that bounty. Badly. So he'd tracked the Truth Witch to the Southern Wharf District. Only to lose her scent. Shortly after, by sheer luck, he'd run into that Nomatsi girl along the canals. Except that she'd eluded him, too. Worse, Edwin hadn't been able to follow her, for she'd possessed no blood scent. Never in Edwin's 20 years of living had he encountered someone whose blood he could not smell. Never. This surprise had unsettled him. It made his molars grind even more than losing the valuable Truth Witch had. Now here Edwin was, trapped in a ceiling instead of hunting those 2 girls. Edwin pressed his thin bronze spyglass to his eye and peered through a spy hole carved into the ceiling. People streamed over marble floors. vibrant shades of orange, green, and blue velvet sprinkled with pastel silks. It was such a waste of time. Nothing was going to happen at the diplomatic ball, for as Edwin's father always said, the 20-year truce made people lazy and unambitious. When the first throbbing strands of a Nubrevnan four-step hit Edwin's ears and heels began to stamp, he opted for a change of scenery. After a crocodilian scrabble through the tiny space, Edwin reached a ladder. He passed two other mercenaries, who eyed him nervously.
"A demon from the void," they whispered.
And Edwin pretended not to hear. He liked those rumors. After all, there were perks to having people fear him, such as the best choice of stakeout spots. Even the Kartoran Hellbards and the Marstaki Adders, Empress Venice's personal bodyguards, had let Edwin enter the palace walls first. When Edwin hit the edge of the ceiling, a hole opened up. More spying space behind the ballroom wall. A rope ladder of absolutely no quality or defensive use spanned the 50 feet to the floor. It was just another example of how lax the Dalmatis and everyone else had become. Should there be any actual need for the guards in the ceiling, it would take them much too long to descend. Just as the four-step shifted into its second movement, Edwin's boots hit the floor. The violins sang into the shadowy wall space, shaking the dust and the wood with their vibrato. Over them was the light tapping of heels that Edwin recognized as a vine-like dance. Edwin actually knew the Nobrevnin four-step. Not well, and he would rather gut himself on a roasting spit than ever engage in it. But he did know the moves. His mentor had forced him to learn it during those first few years at the monastery. Edwin was just aiming left when a familiar blood scent hit his nose. Venom-laced secrets and endless lies. Edwin didn't know if the rumors were true, if a Marstaki Adder's blood was truly made of acid. But he did know that the Poison Witch bodyguards were best avoided, if for no other reason than how their scents hurt his nose. So Edwin abandoned his leftward track and moved right instead. When at last he found a spy hole, even smaller than those in the ceiling, and pressed his eye to it, the third movement of the four-step had begun. And Edwin's eyebrows shot high. It was only two dancers, their heels and toes clattering against the marble at a speed Edwin had never seen. And even more impressive, a wind had begun to swirl around them. One of the dancers clearly had some form of air magic. Observers pulled back like a tide as the dancers spun, their feet moving stormily onward, though their faces remained still, their eyes thinned and focused. The wind continued to sweep up, twirling in time to the music, in time to the steps. It tossed the girl's skirts, her hair, and it tugged at the gaping viewers as the couple spun past. Yet the longer Edwin watched, mildly entertained by the skill needed to dance with such speed and grace, the more an itch began to tickle Edwin's nose. Instinctively, he scanned the nearest faces and sniffed. He smelled a sharp blood, a wild one, one that reminded him of mountain ranges and cliff sides, of meadows laced with dandelions, and of a truth hidden beneath the snow. A thrill rose in his gut. The Truth Witch was here, at this very party. The final bouncing notes of the four-step rang out, drawing Edwin's eyes back to the dancers. The wind was dying down. They were marching apart for the final pose of the dance. The Nubrevnin man was clearly someone of importance, judging by the way people gazed upon him with fear or respect. But he held little interest for Edwin, for his blood scent was unfamiliar. It was the girl that drew Edwin's eye, drew his witchery. Edwin's smile widened, and his fingers reached for a stiletto strapped over his heart. A heart she had impaled only yesterday. Yet as he wondered who such a woman might be, surely Edwin would have heard of a truth witch, Domna. A loud clapping took over the ballroom. It was from a single source, and though all the other spectators joined in with the applause, this clap remained the loudest. Edwin's limited gaze finally latched onto the pale-haired imperial heir, Leopold. He stood near Empress Venice and waited for people to clear a pathway before he lifted his foot to approach the dancers.
"Well done," Leopold finally called, still clapping. But there was an overdone layer to his applause. "Such magnificent dancers!"
The new Brevnan rounded a shining, flushed face toward the Imperial Prince. He bowed low.
"Prince Leopold."
Leopold only gave him a nod.
"Prince Merrick, you have stolen Sophia from us."
There was no missing the blackness in his tone, nor the intentional way he dismissed the other prince to look pointedly at his uncle, the squat Kartoran emperor who stood nearby. Sophia's expression shifted from its dance-drunk intensity to simple, pink-faced embarrassment.
"Polly,"
she murmured, almost inaudible over the crowds.
"I'm sorry. I lost you in all the people."
"No need to apologize."
Leopold spoke in a far louder voice than her proximity required and spread his arms wide.
"Another dance. Let's make this a Pragan waltz."
Then he swept the truth witch a regal bow and clasped her arms. Edwin's fingers tapped out an excited rhythm on his stiletto. This night had just become very interesting. The truth witch who had tried to rob Guildmaster Yotoluzzi was now dancing with not one, but two princes. Oh, the blood witch named Edwin was no longer bored. No longer bored at all. And now he had work to do.
Safi was sick of dancing. Literally, she felt ill from all the spinning and her breath. She'd not had a single moment to catch it since... Merrick. Prince Merrick. The man who couldn't dress himself properly had turned out to be royalty. The man who'd thrown himself against a cleaved was a prince. It was almost impossible to conceive. Yet it explained his high-chinned bearing, his lack of fear when Safi pushed him, and his willingness to push right back. Something had happened between Safi and Merrick during their dance. Something as powerful as the wind and the music that had gusted around them. A shift in the air that preceded a storm. Hell flames, Safi needed Isolde now. She needed her thread sister to help her sort through this wildness in her chest. As the room and the faces spun past her in another stomach-tilting waltz, as lies and truths crashed over Safi from all directions, she knew she needed to stop. To leave. Yet, just as something had shifted within Safi after the dance, after Merrick, something had shifted within the room. A tension coiling inward like a waiting serpent. And the dancing? It never stopped. 6 times, Safi was swept over the floor in Leopold's arms. Then 6 more times, the Emperor himself insisted on partnering with her. Her hands were clammy and gripped too tightly. Sweat seemed to gather in his pocked skin, and Safi wished Leopold would step back in. Until the music abruptly stopped and the dancing halted with it. Until Henrik called for silence in the room, and beckoned for Safi to join him at a low dais. Until a heavy, impossible sentence fell from Henrik's mouth.
"Behold Sophia von Hastrel, my betrothed and the future Empress of Kartora!"
Safi's knees gave way. She fell against Leopold, who, thank the gods, was nearby. Somehow he managed to sweep her upright,
and twirl her toward a room filled with stilted applause, as if everyone were as shocked by the announcement as she.
"Polly,"
she rasped, gaze fixing on his face.
"Polly, please, tell me, Polly."
"It's true,"
he murmured, squeezing her hand. She tried to draw back, her heart threatening to punch its way from her chest. She'd trusted Leopold. She'd trusted Uncle Aaron, too, yet this... She was not acting as a domina, but as a bride. Leopold wouldn't release her, though. His sea-green eyes had become steely. The gentle slope to his jaw had tensed with an unexpected determination. Safi gasped.
"You knew this was coming. Why didn't you tell me?"
His only response was to tow her, forcefully yet not unkindly, toward his uncle, the Emperor. Safi's future husband.
"To many happy years together!"
Leopold shouted, thrusting Safi forward. She staggered into Henrik's grasp. His sweating hands closed over hers. Safi almost jerked back at his touch and his crooked-toothed smile. Almost shrieked that this was not the freedom she'd been promised. Marrying an emperor was as far from freedom as Safi could imagine. So what was that horseshit of a story her uncle had fed her? As far as Safi could see, this was it. This was the end of everything. She scanned every face in the crowd, her arm quaking in Henrik's. She searched for Uncle Aaron's blue eyes, for Matthew's red head. Anyone for Rut's sake. She just needed someone to hold her gaze and reflect back that it was all right to be furious. To be bone-deep scared. But no one in the crowd was familiar. She even looked for Prince Merrick in his silver-gray coat, but he and the rest of the new Brevnans had vanished from the ball as well. Safi was alone with her shaking knees, with the sickness in her throat, with Henrik's clammy palms crushing her fingers. Then, Safi's frantic gaze landed on a wrinkled face and stout body that she vaguely remembered from her childhood. Domna von Brusk. The woman's hairy chin moved like a cow chewing cud, and she bobbed a curt, reassuring nod at Safi. But as the 24th chimes began to ring and the applause subsided, Domna von Brusk navigated towards Safi. Her eyes never left Safi's face. Her pace never slowed. 4 steps in time to each tolling bell. Then the final chime rang out. It reverberated through the room. Every flame in the ballroom, in the gardens, and on the harbor hissed out. The party descended into black. Edwin was still in the wall when the lights went out. He had slunk along from spy hole to spy hole, never losing sight of the Truth Witch, or her blood scent, since she'd followed the summons of Emperor Henrik. The girl clearly hadn't known what was coming. Never had Edwin seen the blood drain from a person's face so quickly. And for the briefest fraction of a moment, Edwin had felt pity. Yet as Edwin watched the girl tumble toward Emperor Henrik, the hairs on his arms pricked up. Then the hairs on the back of his neck. He had just enough time to think, magic, and then feel his power specify, fire witch, before every flame wafted out. In 2 lung-stretching inhales, Edwin's blood witchery roared to the height of its power, and he made a blood recognition for every shrieking person in the ballroom and every guard in the walls. The ceilings. It was just a cursory recording of different scents, so he could move without sight. And so he could follow who else moved without sight. For someone had just orchestrated this blackout, and Edwin knew immediately that it was linked to the girl, Safiya, because her scent was leaving. As was a second someone with the acrid scent of battlefields and burning bodies, and a third someone who smelled of mountain peaks. and vengeance. Edwin set off toward the nearest of two wall exits when the lamps flared back to life in a second rush of hair-raising magic. Relieved whimpers and sighs drifted through the walls, and pinpricks of yellow light shot through spy holes. Edwin darted for the nearest, and his gaze flew to where his blood witchery told him the girl would be. The space was empty. Completely empty. Where the girl had been standing, she still stood. Somehow she had not moved from Henrik's side. Edwin honed in on her scent. It was not the scent of the girl named Safiya. This was someone else entirely. Someone with an older blood. Much older, in fact. Aether Witch, he thought. Then he specified it to Glamour Witch. Edwin scanned the limited field of people he could see, could smell. But there was no sign of someone working powerful magic. Yet Edwin had no doubt a glamour witch was in that room, manipulating what people saw. Edwin also had no doubt he was the only person anywhere in this building, possibly the entire Witchlands, who could wade through what was going on. It was not arrogance that made him think so, but simple truth. A truth that kept him well paid, and that might, after this evening, lead to employers of greater wealth than Guildmaster Yodolupsi. This girl was a truth witch and the future bride of the Kartoran Emperor. Someone would want to know who had taken her, and that someone would no doubt pay very well. Edwin launched into a quick, light-footed stride once more. The girl was reaching the edge of his range. Though he could track her over long distances, it was easier work if he kept her within 100 paces. Yet as he ran, the person with acrid battlefield blood stepped into his path, and with the man came the smoking stench of actual flames. The fire witch was burning the entrance to the walls. Edwin allowed just the slightest fear to spike through him. Flames bothered him. But then he pushed aside the instinct to stop, to descend into that place. And with a great mental wrench, he brought his mind back to the forefront and shoved more power into his lungs. He also made sure to snap his cloak's fire flap across his nose. The saying that a Carowin monk was prepared for everything was not an understatement. And Edwin took that phrase to a completely different level. His white Carowin cloak was made of salamander fibers, so no fire could burn it. Though the flap would block his ability to track blood scents, he only needed to wear it long enough to get through these flames. Edwin reached the exit, dropped directly into the fire, and dispatched his first knife. Then, as he rolled through the flames and flipped back to his feet, he dispatched a second. The fire witch dove aside, ducking behind a potted plant in the long entrance hall of the palace. The second knife cracked into the clay, shook the azalea bush within. Edwin yanked down his fire flap, and the smell of blood rushed over him. His first knife must have hit the fire witch. Good! Edwin threw his gaze down the hall. He saw nothing, yet he sensed the girl was almost to the large doors at the end. The fire witch spun around the other side of the pot. Flames roared from his mouth, his eyes, even as blood gushed from a knife in his knee. Edwin had never seen anything like it. Never known a fire witch could possess such power. Yet he could ponder that later. Leaping aside, he propelled himself into a sprint that was impossible to follow. Edwin could control his own blood, which meant that for spurts of exhausting intensity, he could push his body to an extreme level of speed, of power. Yet as he raced over the marble floor, more figures materialized before him, from around pots and even dropped on ropes from the ceiling. Edwin jolted. His footsteps faltered as he instinctively grabbed for more throwing knives. But no. As these shadowy shapes ran toward Edwin, he realized He smelled nothing. No scent. No blood. The Glamour Witch was still at work here. So Edwin thrust himself back into his blood-fueled sprint. His toes barely skimmed the marble. The shadows approached. Flames thundered, hot and desperate behind him. Then Edwin was close enough to the entrance doors to slow his speed. Gulping in air and throwing all of his blood witchery back into tracking the Truth Witch, he almost forgot to keep an eye out for real people. A fatal mistake for anyone but a blood witch. And as a gold-hilted knife thunked into Edwin's shoulder, a temper he rarely released rumbled to life, then erupted. With a battle cry, Edwin ripped his sword from its scabbard and attacked the person ahead. The person whose knife was now scraping against his shoulder bone. A man with fair hair. The Silk Guild Master, Alex. The tiny, effeminate man was unarmed. He was waiting to die. Willing to die. But Edwin never fought the undefended. He barely had time to redirect his aim. His sword whisked past the man's shoulder, skimmed over his silk robe. The guildmaster only spread his arms as if to say, "Take me," and his eyes never opened, which meant that the concentrated crease on the man's brow was one of attention, of a witchery focused elsewhere. And Edwin smelled a blood scent of tornadoes and silk, of glamours and woven illusions. This man was the Glamour Witch. A man Edwin's own master, Yotoluzzi, had dined with on 1,000 occasions. The man who led the Silk Guild wasn't magically tied to silk at all. As this realization washed over Edwin, he also realized he'd lost Safiya's scent. She had left his 100-pace range, and he would have to track her like a dog on the hunt. Edwin launched into a sprint, a natural one, out the door, where 20 city guards waited beneath a glaring white moon. It was nothing Edwin couldn't handle. In fact, it was almost laughable. 20 men couldn't stop him. All they could do was slow him, at best. Yet as Edwin's sword arced up and his magic reached for the nearest soldier, and as 4 crossbow bolts chunked into Edwin's chest, he realized these men moved with the concerted effort of an army. By the time Edwin waded through all of these swords and arrows and knives, he might actually be too drained to keep following the girl, Safiya. So he did something he rarely ever did, if only because he hated acquiring life debts. He pinched the blue opal pierced in his left ear and whispered, "Come." Blue light flashed in the corner of his eye. Magic shivered down the side of his body. The Threadstone was now active. Which meant every Carowin monk in the area would come to Edwin's aid. 12. As Safi hurtled through the Doge's marble entrance hall, Uncle Aaron towing her along at a speed she had never seen him run, she had absolutely no idea what was happening. The lights had blacked out, and then Habim's hand had slid around Safi's. She hadn't known how she'd recognized him. Years of grasping those same hilt-roughened palms was all she could figure. But she had known, and she'd followed without question. But the lights had flared into being before she or Habim or Uncle Aaron were out of the ballroom. Most gazes were locked on where Safi had just stood, and the few gazes that scanned toward her simply skimmed over. She risked a peek back and saw herself, standing exactly as she had stood. False, her magic frizzed against her spine. Then Habim towed Safi into the dark hall, and all she could do was try to keep her silver skirts out of the way as she and Aaron hurtled through the hall. Habim hung back. "Faster," Aaron hissed, never looking at his niece, never offering an explanation for what in the rutting hell was going on. Uncle Aaron had hidden things and bent the truth, but he hadn't outright lied. It was midnight. Safi was leaving. Safi and Aaron's heels echoed through the hall like the city guard's snare drums, until a boom ripped out. Flames. But Safi kept her gaze locked on Aaron's graying head, and her mind focused on pumping every ounce of speed into her legs. She wouldn't look back. She would trip if she did. They were almost to the doors outside when Safi caught sight of Guildmaster Alex, sweating and concentrated. Yet what he was doing or why, Safi had no time to ponder. She simply leaped over the threshold and into an army. A cry writhed up her throat, but Aaron cut directly through the men, who one by one saluted him. Safi had never, never seen people give her uncle respect. She almost lost control of her feet, of her lungs. But then Aaron glanced back, and the sharpness in his gaze, the precursor to a temper she recognized and understood, sent her into a frenzied race once more. Over the stone paths, beneath the hanging jasmine, Safi's feet didn't slow. She had finally reached that strange aloofness Isolde latched onto so easily, the place Habim had tried to teach Safi for years. Just as he had taught her to defend herself. Just as he had taught her to fight and to maim, and to sprint like the void was at her heels. As Aaron guided her down a narrow gardener's path and toward a nondescript worker's gate in the iron fence around the palace, Safi realized that Uncle Aaron had never intended for her to be a domna. Every piece of her training, every lesson Matthew and Habim had ever hammered into her brain, had been leading up to this moment. The moment when she would be declared the future Empress of Kartora and would run away from it at breakneck speed. Aaron reached the gate. It swung wide, and Matthew appeared. But Aaron did not slow. In fact, now in the open street, he picked up his pace. So did Safi and Matthew. Three sets of rasping breaths soon filled every space in Safi's ears. Louder than the night wind or the rising clash of steel on steel, a battle that now raged within the palace walls. They reached an intersection, and Aaron darted into the shadow of an overhang. Safi followed, blinking at the sudden loss of moonlight. Then, as her eyes adjusted, a cart and donkey coalesced before her. A wiry peasant sat disinterestedly at the cart's front, sunflower stalks as his cargo. Aaron snatched a clump of sunflowers and flipped them back. They were attached to a blanket of salamander fibers. "Get under," Aaron ordered, his voice raw with exertion. "We'll deal with the Blood Witch, but until then, you need to hide." Safi didn't get under. Instead, she grabbed her uncle's arm. "What's going on?" Her words were split by gasps. "Where am I going?" "You have to escape," he said. "Not just the city, but all of Dalmati. If we're caught, we'll be hung as traitors." Aaron dropped the edge of the blanket and yanked a flask from his waistcoat. A swig, a swish, and he spat it to the cobblestones. Three more times he did this while Safi gaped on. Then Aaron mussed his hair and shot Safi a rigid stare. "Do not fail us," he said quietly, before staggering around and shuffling off. It was like watching summer turn to winter. Aaron von Hastrel transformed before Safi's eyes. The cold, soldier-like uncle she'd seen seconds before became a grinning, sloppy-faced drunk. And nothing in Safi's magic reacted. It was as if both versions of her uncle were true. Or false, for she could sense nothing at all. In that moment, a sickening horror scalded through her. Her uncle had never been a drunk. As inconceivable as it was, as unwieldy and too oddly shaped for her mind to grab onto, There was no denying what Safi could plainly see. Uncle Aaron had convinced Safi, Safi's magic, and all of Kartora that he was nothing more than a wasted old fool. And then he'd used that lie to help her escape tonight. Before Safi could call out to him and beg for answers, his figure shimmered once and then vanished. Where he'd walked, Safi saw only cobblestones and moonbeams. She jerked toward Matthew.
Where did he go? Did the Glamour Witch do that?
Matthew nodded. I told you your uncle's plan was big. We fear. No. We know that the truth will dissolve any day now and with no hope for a continuation. At Safi's confused headshake, Matthew sighed. I know it's impossible for you to understand right now, but trust me. We're working for peace, Safi. Yet a union to Emperor Henrik would have ruined everything.
But why? Safi stammered. Does Henrik want to marry me in the first place? The Hastral lands are worthless. I'm worthless.
Matthew hesitated, eyes flicking away before he finally said, We think the Emperor might have learned about your witchery.
Safi's throat squeezed shut. How? She wanted to croak.
She'd hidden it for 18 years, and no hellbard had caught her yet.
A marriage to Henrik, Matthew went on, would have been the same thing as enslavement for you, Safi. There would have been no escape. Yet since neither Aaron nor you can openly oppose such a union, we're faking this kidnapping. That was why Aaron gave you no warning. If you had known what was to come, then you wouldn't have shown nearly enough surprise. Henrik and his hellbards would have suspected immediately.
Safi swallowed. Or tried to. Her throat was too clogged. Not only did that blood witch know what she was, but the Emperor of Kartora did too. Who else had found out? Who else would come hunting for her?
Don't worry, Matthew said, clearly sensing her panic. Everything is prepared, Safi, and we'll get you to safety.
He pushed her toward the black blanket, but she dug in her heels.
What about Isolde? I'm not leaving her.
Habim and I will find her.
No!
Safi ripped from his grasp, not caring that smoke plumed over rooftops now, that the roar of a nearby battle grew louder each second she stood her ground.
I'm not leaving without Isolde. Tell me where I'm supposed to go, and I'll get there on my own.
Even after all of this, you still don't trust us.
In the darkness, Matthew's face was hidden, yet there was no missing the hurt in his voice.
We risked everything to get you from that party.
I don't trust Uncle Aaron, Safi said. Not after what I've seen tonight.
You should trust him. He built a life of shadows and lies, yet he never dragged you into it. Do you know how much that cost him? Cost all of us.
Matthew motioned vaguely toward the cart.
Believe me when I say that Dom Aaron wants nothing more than to keep you safe. That's what we all want. Now, come. We're out of time.
Matthew gripped Safi's elbow, and his shaded eyes bored into hers.
You will ride this cart north, Safi, to meet a boat. You will not move until you get there. The boat will carry you across the sea to a city called Lejna in the Hundred Isles, where you will wait at a coffee shop, one of my coffee shops. Someone will come for you in 4 days and take you the rest of the way. To freedom, Safi, so you won't have to marry Henrik. And I promise, on my life and Habim's, I promise to bring Isolde with us.
The words trailed over Safi. They buzzed through her arm where Matthew's skin touched her.
He was bewitching her.
She knew he was doing it. Her own truth witchery screeched at her that this was deception. yet Matthew's magic was stronger than Safi's. She could no more fight it than the pull of a riptide. Her feet carried her to the cart. Her body crawled beneath the blanket, and her mouth said,
"I will see you across the sea, Matthew."
Her tutor's face tightened. A wince of pain or regret, Safi couldn't say. She was drowning beneath the power of his witchery. But when he leaned in to brush a kiss over her forehead, she had no doubt the emotion was one of love, of family. Then he dropped the blanket over her head, the world turned black, and the cart rattled to a start beneath her. It felt like years that Safi was beneath the awful salamander blanket with sunflower leaves scratching overhead. She heard little beyond the donkey's hooves and the creaking wheels. She smelled nothing but her own hot breath, and she saw only black. Yet Matthew's word witchery held its sway, the words so deep in her brain that she had to obey, had to lie there, silent and still, while the cart rolled north. Never, never had Matthew done that to her. Perhaps a coercive phrase or two, but her truth witchery had always cancelled it out. This was so much power that she was still bound to it a ring of the chimes later. A silent cry simmered in Safi's chest. Aaron had used her. He had kept this enormous secret so she would be genuinely surprised at the party. And that was goat crap. Safi wasn't some puppet to be flicked around on a stage, or a tarot card to be tossed out at her uncle's whim. And how did Safi even know Uncle Aaron was actually shipping her off to freedom? Clearly, her witchery failed her when faced with his lies and promises. If Aaron had so effortlessly twisted the truth about tonight's events, then he could do so again. Sickened heat rushed into Safi's mouth, coated her tongue. Isolt was the only person Safi could trust, and the girls had a life in Vinyatsa City. A simple life, perhaps, but one that was all their own. Safi couldn't give up on that. Yet for how long would Isolt wait at the lighthouse? For that matter, if Isolt was at the lighthouse now, wouldn't that mean Matthew and Habim wouldn't know where to find her? How could they bring Isolt with them if she wasn't where she was supposed to be? They couldn't. Which meant it was time for Safi to take control of her own strings, to play her own cards once more. Time passed. Safi's determination strengthened, and at last Matthew's magic relinquished its hold. In frantic, jerky movements, Safi shimmied to the edge of the cart to lift up the blanket. Fresh air washed over her, as did moonlight. She gulped it in, blinking and squinting and so grateful to be moving again. Thatch-roofed inns and taverns bounced by. Stable yards, too. This was the edge of Vinyatsa City, where inns clustered and empty roads began. If Safi traveled much farther, she'd have no chance of finding a steed, of bounding farther north to the lighthouse. Plus, Safi needed a weapon. A girl dressed in fine silk and traveling alone was clearly asking for trouble. As Safi's eyes ran over a stable yard, she glimpsed a tired stable boy leading a mottled gray gelding, the horse's head upright. He was alert and ready to ride. Even better, there was a pitchfork beside the entrance to the yard. It wasn't a sword, and it was certainly heavier than Safi usually wielded. But she had no doubt she could use it against anyone who got in her way. She peeled back the blanket a few more inches and peeked at the peasant driving the cart. He didn't look back. So, with a swing of her legs and a thrust of her arms, she rolled off the cart. She froze on the dried mud while her body reoriented. There was no sound of the ocean, though the rhythm in the wind suggested the coast was near, as did the faint stench of fish. Though she didn't recognize the suburb, Safi could guess that the lighthouse was near, a few miles north at most. She darted toward the inn's yard as fast as her feet could carry her. A glance at the cart showed it ambling onward, and then a glance at the gray gelding showed it almost to the stable door. Sophie slowed only once, beneath the inn's arched gate, to heft up the pitchfork. It was definitely heavier than her sword. But the iron wasn't rusted, and the fork points were sharp. She raised it high, pleased when the scrawny stable boy caught sight of her charging his way. He blanched, dropped the horse's reins, and cowered against the stable door.
"Thank you for making that easy,"
Sophie declared, grabbing the reins. The horse eyed her curiously but made no move to run. Yet before Sophie could get her foot in the stirrup, her eyes landed on a small leather scabbard on the stable boy's belt. She stomped her foot back down and heaved the pitchfork back up.
"Give me your knife."
But it was a present,"
the boy began.
"Do I look like I care? If you give me that knife, I'll give you enough silk to buy 25 knives just like it."
He hesitated, clearly trying to figure out how that deal would work. And Sophie bared her teeth. He fumbled the knife from his belt. She took it, stabbed the pitchfork in the mud, and snatched up her skirts. But the knife was dull and the silk strong. It took too many heartbeats to rip the blade through. A cry of alarm went up in the inn. Whoever this gray belonged to had decided he wanted to keep him. Sophie threw the layers of silk in the boy's face. Then, with a great deal less grace than she normally exhibited when mounting a horse, she clambered into the gelding's saddle, gripped her new knife tight, laid the pitchfork over the pommel, and kicked into a canter. The horse's owner reached the doorway just in time to see Sophie wave goodbye and to hear her shout, "Thank you!" She gave the man one of her very brightest smiles. Then she veered the horse south and away from the northbound cart. She would circle around to a different street ahead. But she didn't get far. In fact, the gray had barely galloped to the next inn when she realized something was wrong. There were 5 men in the street before her. They jogged in a perfect row, their white cloaks streaming behind them and their scabbards and weapons clanking. Carowin monks. And the one in the middle was covered in blood. He even had arrow shafts poking out from his chest, his legs, his arms. Blood witch. Sophie's stomach punched into her lungs. Aaron had tried and failed to stop the monk. With movements that felt impossibly slow, Sophie yanked at the reins and wrenched the gelding north. Thank the gods the horse was well trained. His hooves kicked up dried mud and he galloped in this new direction. Sophie didn't look back. She knew the monks would follow. The last inn blurred past and a world of marshy coastline spread before her. Far in the distance, the road inclined into cliff sides and limestone. In moments, the cart and driver she'd just escaped came into view. And there was no missing the man's witch mark. Its shape was familiar enough to recognize, even with her speed. The man was not a peasant at all, but a voice witch. Sophie had just enough time to scream at him,
"The blood witch hunts me! Tell my uncle!"
before barreling past him down the empty, moonlit road. 13. Isolde and Alma caught up to Gretcha in moments. Shouts pursued for a time, as did the writhing gray threads of the violent, but only 2 more arrows thunked into Alma's shield. And somehow, though Alma did not follow the Nomatsi trails, her mare's footing was sure. After what felt like an hour, Alma directed the horses to a wide willow on a lazy brook. Gretcha hopped down first, a fire pot in hand and scruffs at her side. She circled the tree before motioning that all was clear. Isolde slid off the horse and almost toppled into her mother. Her legs were rubber and her arm.
You've lost too much blood, Gretcha said. Come.
She took Iselt's hand and guided her into a world of drooping branches and whispering leaves. The bay mare followed willingly, as if she knew this place. The stolen brindle, however, took some convincing from Alma.
You plant this,
Iselt croaked, following her mother to a tree trunk dappled in moonlight.
Yes, but not for tonight.
Gretcha lifted a long stick from against the tree and motioned up to where two lumps sat on branches just out of reach. And just out of notice, Gretcha batted off both sacks. Thump, thump. The bulging satchels hit the earth and dust plumed. A green apple rolled out. Iselt dragged herself onto the willow's roots, her back against the wide trunk. Scruffs settled beside her, and with her left hand, she scratched at his ears while Alma continued to coax the pony beneath the branches, the now arrow-filled Nomatsi shield still affixed to her back. Though Iselt couldn't see the blood on her right sleeve, not in this darkness, she couldn't miss the pain.
At least, she thought dimly, the cut on my right hand doesn't hurt anymore.
After rummaging in the bags, Gretcha bustled to Iselt's side with the dusty apple and a leather healer kit in tow. She wiped the apple on her bodice.
Eat this.
Iselt took it, but barely got it to her mouth before her mother offered her a pendant. A small rose quartz hung from the end of a braided string.
Wear it,
Gretcha ordered, crouching on the earth beside Iselt. But Iselt made no move to take the necklace. An apple was one thing, but pain stones were rare and cost hundreds of piastras. Gretcha tossed the stone impatiently. It landed on Iselt's lap, the quartz glowing a dim pink. Instantly, the pain reared back. Iselt's breaths deepened. She felt capable of thinking again. No wonder these things were addictive. Iselt's gaze settled on Alma once more, who now stood at the edge of the hanging branches with her back to Iselt and Gretcha. She kept watch while the horses munched at small patches of grass.
Corlant,
Iselt began as Gretcha scooted to her side, a lancet in one hand and linen cloths in the other.
Wanted to kill me. Why?
I don't know. Gretcha hesitated.
I can only guess that he thought your arrival was a sign that Alma and I were leaving. He figured out our plans, I think, and hoped to keep us in the settlement by hanging you—
She broke off, wet her lips, and did not finish the sentence. Before Iselt could point out that Corlant's measures seemed much too extreme if all he wanted was to keep Gretcha in the tribe, Gretcha was slicing through the arrow shaft poking from Iselt's bicep. Then she grasped the arrowhead on the left side and yanked it through. Blood gushed. It pulsed out in time to Iselt's heartbeat. Not that she could feel it. In fact, she simply munched on her apple, occasionally patted Scruff's head and watched her mother work. Next came healer witch salves to ward off infection and creams to speed healing. They were all pricey items. Yet before Iselt could protest, Gretcha began to speak, and Iselt found herself falling into the familiar, inflectionless voice of her childhood.
Alma and I began making preparations to flee shortly before you left, 6.5 years ago,
Gretcha explained.
We gathered piastras and gemstones one by one. Then one by one we sewed them into our gowns. It was slow work. Corlant was often there, forcing himself into the house. Yet he also left often, vanishing from the settlement entirely for days at a time. During those times, Alma would take the mare here and drop off supplies. She brought the last of our things only yesterday. Our plan was to flee 4 days from now. I owe the Moon Mother 1,000 thank yous that we did not leave before you came. Somehow, amongst all those words, the ones that shone the brightest for Iselt were the ones unspoken. You planned all this, before I was even gone from the tribe. Why did you send me away, then?